Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we meet a proponent of reconciling Islam with religious, political, economic, and social freedoms. Democracy, in a word. Turkish journalist Mustafa Akyol is a columnist for two Turkish newspapers, Hürriyet Daily News and Star, and is the author of Islam Without Extremes, A Muslim Case for Liberty. In it, he argues that the longtime conflict over Islamic theology, which traditionally has favored a rigid, dogmatic view of Islam, is starting to slowly change and give way, painfully at times, to a more rational and flexible reading of Islam. The book argues that we in the West should resist the urge to view repressive regimes in Muslim areas as Islamic, but simply authoritarian in nature. Akyol's writing has appeared in Foreign Affairs, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, and International Herald Tribune, and he's spoken at think tanks ranging from the Council on Foreign Relations and the Brookings Institution to the Cato Institute and the Heritage Foundation. He will be the keynote speaker at the Institute of Interfaith Dialogue's annual Friendship Dinner and Award Ceremony Tuesday night at the DoubleTree Hotel. He'll be speaking on opportunities for democracy and liberties in the Middle East. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Mustafa Akyol, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich, for having me, and it's my pleasure.
You've been a liberal voice for how Islam has affected the states of the Middle East, with the exception of Turkey. Most of these states are creations of the past century, the 20th century. And you've said that Islam was articulated and interpreted by medieval scholars, and for whatever reason, that interpretation is basically stuck in time. And your goal, I guess, as a liberal, is to try to unstick that interpretation. How do you go about doing that?
You're right. One of my projects, one of my efforts, is to look at the whole tradition that we call Islam and try to understand what is historical in it. And by historical, here's what I mean. Islam is basically based on the Quran and the prophetic tradition and the examples of the prophets. But what do they really mean has been interpreted by medieval scholars according to their time and milieu. Like medieval Islamic scholars, for example, developed a political idea, a political doctrine of how the world should be. But at that time, there was no United Nations, no international law, no sense of their institutions that we have right now. So they basically thought Muslims will be secure only in a world where only in a land which is ruled by Islamic law and none and other countries are house of war, are dangerous places for Muslims. But actually, when we look at the modern world today, we see that Muslims feel pretty safe and secure and free in some non-Islamic countries like the United States or Europe, because these are the states that have laws that respect international treaties, freedom, human rights. So this is a whole new world. So if we stick to the interpretation of the Quran that was done by medieval scholars with the best of intentions, but in medieval context, then we are actually doing something very wrong. We are not representing our values. We're just repeating an old mantra, which doesn't make sense today. So in my book, with this vision, I especially go to the authoritarian aspects in Islam, like the ban on apostasy or changing your religion from Islam to another religion, or blasphemy laws and things like that. And I show that how we Muslims can and should revisit those laws. That won't be a treason to Islam. That won't be a treason to our faith and values. It will be only rearticulating them in the modern world, in the new context that we live in.
Why do you suppose that interpretation was stuck in time? When you look at Judaism and Christianity, the two religions so closely related to Islam, you see there has been, although there were long periods, say, in Christianity, 400 or 500 years, maybe even 700 years, where that staticness was in place in the religion, but yet there were people who were re-envisioning it and understanding it, and as state powers changed, so did the religious powers over time, and to a varying degree. And that's something we should always keep in mind. But why do you suppose Islam hasn't had that same thought process that has guided these two other religions from writings which are no longer really thought to be carrying through?
Well, of course, Judaism and Christianity, too, until very recently, had quite illiberal interpretations. I mean, the liberalism and Catholicism is a product of the Vatican II in the 60s. Yeah, but even in the 19th century, some Protestant sects were very authoritarian in some issues. And Judaism has, even today, very ultra-Orthodox, you know, interpretations, as you know. However, it is true that Judaism and Christianity in the West have made their peace with an open, liberal, democratic society. And I think this is mostly related with the fact that liberal democracy emerged in the Western world, and Judaism and Christianity happened to be in the West. So they faced this before, they struggled with it, they came to terms with it, they revisited their faith, they rethought their faith, and they have come up with different interpretations and reinterpretations. I think Islam needs to go through the same process, and it is actually going through, but it's a challenging process, for an additional reason. For Christianity and Judaism in the West, the issue was modernity, but modernity was within the West, and they were Westerners. But for Muslims, modernity is a product of the West, which is a different civilization. So it's probably a bigger burden, psychological burden, to accept something from a civilization that is more powerful or sometimes even more threatening towards you. So that brings other dichotomies. Plus, I should also acknowledge that unlike Christianity, Islam has a more extensive legal aspect. In that sense, Islam is more closer to Judaism, I would say, than Christianity, because both has an idea of a divine law and a whole way of life. In Judaism, it's called the halakha. In Islam, it's called the sharia. And actually, some aspects of halakha are quite illiberal. And when you compare with sharia, it's not less illiberal, at least. But Jews in the modern world today, for example, have different trends, Reformed Jews, Orthodox Jews, Conservative Jews. And I think the same, at least diversity, is needed in Islam. And I have no problems, honestly, in seeing some very ultra-conservative Muslims living in the way they understand Islam. I have no problem with a woman wearing a burqa, if that's her choice. But I also know that that should not be imposed by the state or the community, and it should be a woman's decision to wear the burqa, or if she wants to wear a miniskirt. So establishing that pluralism is Islam is a key concept here, and I think that actually there is some progress in the modern world. It's a challenging process, as it was for Christianity and Judaism.
There's certainly been many scholars that have talked about this liberal reinterpretation, but it seems like from long-range viewpoints that a lot of times those voices are marginalized, harried, perhaps even persecuted. In many of the Middle Eastern countries.
Yes, I mean, you're right, but it depends on which country we're talking about. In Saudi Arabia, still, for
yes.
Sure, liberal voices are not that welcome. In Turkey, where I come from, where I live, it's not like that. There are theologians who really bring very liberal modern interpretations, and some agree with them, some don't, but nobody's persecuted and nobody's vilified, although we have intense debate for sure. So it depends on which Muslim country are we talking about and which Muslim society are we talking about. Of course, one problem is that the episodes that make the news are, of course, the most horrifying episodes. When a Saudi cleric in Saudi Arabia says there should be no churches in the Arabian Peninsula, that becomes the news. But there are other clerics who would say this is insane. Islam has always respected Judaism and Christianity, and we have always had churches and synagogues in the Muslim world. That's not news. So, yes, there are very close-minded people, and they still block the way for change. But they're not the only one, although they really are the ones who really make the news most of the time.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things you often write about is when we think of Islam, we also have to think of authoritarianism, which is a big part of most of these regimes, some of which are toppling or in the process of toppling. But we have to keep in mind that what may appear to be Islam is actually authoritarianism, and what may appear to be authoritarian is Islam? Is it that simple?
You're right. I mean, if you looked at the medieval Europe and look at Inquisition, you would conclude that Christianity is an authoritarian religion, but it was just one of the expressions of Christianity, which came from maybe different cultural structures. In the Muslim world today, in the world that we call the Muslim world today, there is obviously a lack of freedom. There are hardly any liberal democratic governments, a few, and they are not even liberal enough. But again, as you said, is this problem coming directly from Islam or from other problems? Now, I had this question in my mind for the first time. Then I noticed that the secular politicians in Turkey, or the secular intellectuals, were quite authoritarian as well. For example, in Turkey, we had laws that banned women from wearing the headscarf, Islamic headscarf. Now, I think it is as illiberal as ordering women to wear the headscarf. And when I saw these things, I said, well, in Iran, for example, there's a law which says women should wear the headscarf. In Turkey, there's a law which says women should not wear the headscarf. And I said, problem is not Islam or headscarf here. The problem is an authoritarian political culture that thinks that the state should tell people what to do. So my effort in my book, Islam Without Extremes, is to detach Islam from this authoritarian political culture that happens to be very strong in the Middle East, and not just in the Muslim world, by the way. Also look at China or Russia. Mm-hmm. So detach Islam from this and to ask whether we can have liberal interpretations of Islam. And I also show that actually those liberal interpretations of Islam has some grounding in history, in late Ottoman Empire and even modern-day Turkey today.
Now, I was interested about the later Ottoman Empire because was it a sense of a liberalization or was it more a sense of the collapsing nature of the Ottoman Empire at that point, in the 19th century, in the years leading up to World War I, which eventually collapsed the empire?
Both. I mean, the Ottoman Empire was certainly collapsing in the early 20th century, and there was a lot of concern about it, and there was a lot of measures taken to prevent that collapse, including some drastic and horrific measures, such as the expulsion of Armenians.
Yes.
So that's a certainly important story. But what I also focus on the book is the Ottoman effort to liberalize the empire in the 19th century. This, for example, means opening up a parliament, enacting a secular, not secular, but liberal constitution, accepting Jews and Christians as equal citizens of the empire and appointing them to high places. All of these developments took place in late Ottoman Empire, which was the very center of the Islamic Caliphate, most important Islamic authority on earth. However, today in Saudi Arabia, there are people who still think that a parliament is un-Islamic, although the Ottomans opened a parliament under the caliphate, an elected parliament in the 19th century. So I think that episode of the Ottoman Empire as an Islamic state trying to reform itself, bring more rights to women, expand education, bring equality to everybody, allowing people to change their religion, which is still a big important issue in our part of the world, is forgotten. And one of my chapters in the book looks at those Ottoman reforms and shows how it is possible for Islamic-minded people to appreciate some concepts of what we call Western liberalism and even to find Islamic justifications for that, as some Ottoman liberals did in the 19th century. For example, when they thought of democracy, they said, well, it is very compatible with the Quranic principles of consultation, whether you agreed or not, but they defended democracy on this basis.
Give us a contemporary example that would fit in with that.
Well, the contemporary example is, again, liberal voices in the Muslim world. For example, in Turkey, we have certainly a liberal Islamic trend. There are intellectuals, theologians, or scholars who argue for a full compatibility of Islam and democracy and a secular state. In the Arab world, there are people like Rashid Ghannouchi, the leader of the Nahda party in Tunisia, which argue that every citizen's security and freedom should be respected, and that people should be able to leave Islam if they want to, because that apostasy issue is still a big problem in the Muslim world, and that there should be no compulsion, no authoritarianism in religious matters. So these are the more liberal voices, and for example, I can point certainly to Ghannouchi as one of those voices in the Muslim world. But then there are the Salafis in those countries too, who obviously do not want to hear these arguments and who want to impose their literalist interpretation on everybody.
My guest today is Mustafa Akgul, a Turkish columnist for Hurriyet Daily News and Star in Istanbul, the author of Islam Without Extremes, A Muslim Case for Liberty. He'll be the featured guest at the Institute of Interfaith Dialogues annual Friendship Dinner and Awards on October 23rd, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. I would like to ask, you had a recent column which kind of addressed some of these issues, and it was titled What's Happening to Turkish Society? And it looked at years of, you've had secular culture in Turkey, and at some point authoritarian secular culture. But in recent years, you write that religion has become more important, but still within the confines of a secular government. In fact, the secular government actually makes religion more important within the home than maybe in states where that religion is imposed by the state.
You're right. In that column, I show that based on social surveys made by important Turkish think tanks, I underline the fact that Turkish society in the past decade has not become necessarily more religious or more closed-minded, as some people argued. But I've argued that the religious people in Turkish society have become more mainstream. They've become more center. They've become in power politically and even economically. They've become more prominent. But they also became a bit more open-minded and more willing to tolerate people of other faiths or people without any faith at all. And one thing I also underline there is that, I mean, I think we've made an unnecessarily big emphasis on secularism in the Muslim world. Because I've seen that, I mean, secular people can be very close-minded as well, and secular political systems can be. And just look at communism the whole 20th century. I mean, the fact that something is secular instead of being religious doesn't make it necessarily democratic or liberal. That's why I focus on liberalism in the classical sense, in the sense of appreciating, respecting everybody's personal choices. And that's, I think, the core principle idea that we should seek. And some people are liberal. Some secular people are. Some secular people are not. And some religious people can become liberals as well, as we have seen in the Turkish case.
And you actually write very eloquently about your own family story in which your father was imprisoned by a secular government, basically clamping down on dissent or anything that could be considered dissent.
Definitely. My father, who was a journalist and who still is a prominent journalist in Turkey, was imprisoned, like many other intellectuals in Turkey, for no reason during the military coup of 1980. And that military coup really imprisoned, even tortured many people just out of their ideas. It was very authoritarian, but it was also very secular. It was based on the ideas of Turkey's secular founder, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. And when I see examples like that, and when I see an authoritarian government in Iran, I understand that the problem is with authoritarianism, with this unconstrained power, this overpowerful state, and the political culture which venerates the state and its authority over its unlimited authority over people. And when you have an authoritarian religious government, you have secular opponents to it, and that's welcome. When you sometimes have a secular authoritarian government in Turkey, Islamic people emerge as the liberal critiques of the government in the past 10 decades. That's why the discussions in Turkey, I think, in the past two decades are important for world Muslims to realize. Because, for example, we have Islamic feminists in Turkey who cry for freedom, and when they cry for freedom, they say, we want to wear the headscarf. The government cannot tell us what to do. And of course, by default, they defend the right of other women who don't want to wear a headscarf or who are Christians or who are Armenians or whatever. So they defend their rights as well. So that experience of fighting for freedom have educated them to become more principled liberals.
Let's talk about, I was really struck by something you said about the current ruling party in Turkey, because American conservatives sometimes worry about where Turkey is headed. The rejection of the EU to Turkey was, we've been wondering what that effect will have in the West. And they worry about the AKP, the ruling party of Prime Minister Erdogan. And I notice you've said, it's not that AKP is not too Islamic, it's too Turkish. And I guess this gets this idea of secular authoritarianism. Is that what you were getting at?
Well, secular or not, I mean, what I said, well, I meant by saying AKP is not too Islamic, but too Turkish is this. I mean, the AKP, the governing party in Turkey, it's in power for 10 years right now, and it's winning every election. It's a very successful party in terms of the economy, and many people vote for them for that success. But it's a party that is formed by pious religious people, and they used to be more Islamist in the past, but they transformed themselves to a more democratic force. Now, the AKP, this party, this so-called Islamic party, did the most extensive European Union accession reforms in Turkey, and they have really got support a lot from Turkey's secular liberals for that. And that actually shows that a party with an Islamic spirit, if you will, I'm not saying an Islamic dogma, because parties, I think, should be by definition secular to attract all sorts of voters. But with an Islamic spirit can be liberal and can serve the cause of liberalism in this part of the world. The problem with AKP, though, which is becoming more apparent in the past few years, is that they're just getting used to be very powerful, very popular, and honestly, they're becoming very arrogant. And like most Turkish political parties, the AKP has become a one-man show. Erdogan is the leader that everybody listens to. And I said, and they're very confrontational with the opposition and so on and so forth. But these are problems that we see in other Turkish political parties as well.
And so, other political parties across the West as well.
When you're in power for a while. The more people, power corrupts, as you know, Lord Acton said well. So there are problems with politics in this part of the world, and sometimes those problems do not come from Islam. It comes from dynamics of politics, which are really problematic everywhere, as you all said. The only thing in the U.S., I think, in the U.S., you have established a great system of checks and balances that no matter how people are arrogant or being intoxicated with power, there are systematic checks on power. Whereas in Turkey, we need to develop more of that, obviously.
My guest today is Mustafa Akyol, a columnist for the Turkish newspaper Hürriyet Daily News and Star. He's the author of Islam Without Extremes, A Muslim Case for Liberty. He'll be a featured guest at the Institute of Interfaith Dialogue's annual dinner and awards. And he'll be speaking on opportunities for democracies and liberties in the Middle East. In our last few minutes, I'd like to talk about this. You've written a great deal about the emerging democracy movement in the Middle East. And I think while we in the West have applauded these people power movements, there is intense speculation and, frankly, fear in the West over whether these movements will eventually evolve to a democratic state or theocratic states. What's your view?
Well, no revolution brings a very rosy picture right away. I mean, let's remember the French Revolution, of which I'm not a fan, I should say.
Yeah.
You know, took a lot of time to, you know, create a more stable liberal democracy in France. I even doubt there's still a liberal democracy in France, but that's another discussion. But I think these revolutions have been helpful, especially in Tunisia, where there was almost a peaceful transition to a multi-party system. And the Islamists have become members, legitimate actors in the game, and they're becoming more moderate and more pragmatic. And I think I expect the same thing to happen in Egypt, too. Now, we should see one thing. In the past, regimes like that of Hosni Mubarak in Egypt were praised in the West as, oh, secular-minded, these are more secular, more Western-friendly. Now, the downside of that was that these are very authoritarian regimes, and they were suppressing, torturing opponents, including especially the Islamists. And those Islamists were getting radicalized by the repression, and they were hating not just Mubarak, but also the West. Hence, you had the whole vicious cycle, which ultimately created al-Qaeda. So it is very helpful to break this vicious cycle and bring the Islamists who want a power, well, come to power, but through elections, and you will have another election 4 years from now. And, well, this could have become like the Iranian Revolution, but I don't think that is the case. I don't think that's where we're going. There's still room for concern in Egypt for individual freedoms, for minorities, for women's rights. And that's why the Islamists should be criticized and kept in check by democratic methods. But also they should be allowed to prove themselves. And I think already we're seeing signs of pragmatism in Egypt and in Tunisia and even in Libya among the Islamists. Syria, of course, is a different case. It's an unfinished revolution. It's a very bloody case. And I'm hoping that the tyranny there will fall and there will be a transition to democracy. But it's very tough, as you know. We're hoping for the best.
It's certainly, you're right on the doorstep of this. The tensions between Syria and Turkey have heightened. And I know you've spoke of intervention of the coalition of the willing, but it looks like, at least from all the Western democracies' side, that there is no willing out there.
I know. That's a bad case. I mean, I agree with Senator McCain on this, that the U.S. should have been involved in Syria, at least in terms of airstrikes on the regime, but I know that's not going to happen anytime soon. That's what I see from the Democrat and Republican side on both sides. Well, Syria is a very tough case. The regime proved to be more powerful than what we thought, what anybody had thought. It has powerful supporters like Iran, Hezbollah, and Russia, and even China. You can even add North Korea, you know, to the list, although probably it doesn't add much on the ground. And unfortunately, the revolution in Syria also getting toughened by time. The jihadist elements are joining it. I wish they were not there, but they're there. But I think their presence doesn't delegitimize the opposition. I should also say that. So it's really a very bad situation. And I also support for arming of the opposition in better ways. They should have maybe anti-aircraft missiles to protect themselves from the planes of the regime, which just bombed neighborhoods. So all this is a very complicated picture, and nobody, including me, has a great roadmap to solve this. But I would urge the United States not to, you know, move away from the Middle East, but try to support democracy and freedom and just the lives of innocent people in cases like this. And if there is a more hawkish like administration in the United States vis-a-vis Syria, honestly, I would be happy.
What has been the reaction of the Turkish government? Are they getting involved in this, officially or unofficially?
The Turkish government is obviously involved. The Turkish government strongly supports the Syrian opposition, although the government had good relations with the Syrian regime before the Arab Spring. But once violence started against civilians, they condemned the regime, and now the Turkish government is at odds with the Syrian regime. And this conflict has huge implications on Turkey. There are more than 100,000 refugees right now in Turkey on the Syrian border. These are people fleeing from violence of Assad regime. And Turkey is supporting the opposition, but it cannot change reality on the ground. Some people expect Turkey to occupy Syria, at least for a buffer zone, but I don't think that's going to happen because it's very dangerous for Turkey. We are at the border, and Syria has chemical weapons and a big arsenal, and I don't think nobody in Turkey wants a war, which will obviously hit and hurt Turkey. But Turkey is very concerned, and Turkey is supporting the opposition and hoping that there will be a transition of some sorts.
What is the effect of those 100,000 refugees been on the border area?
Well, they are in camps right now, camps visited by Angelina Jolie recently, and she praised how the Turkish government is taking care of the refugees and in the best condition she has ever seen before. That's all fine, but it's a big toll on the Turkish government in terms of the expenses, and even there are tensions between some locals and the refugees. And now more people are coming. Every day, hundreds, sometimes thousands of people flee from the Syrian border into Turkey to save their lives. And Turkish government will not send them back for sure. But as the toll becomes unbearable, Turkey is seriously considering a buffer zone. And of course, Turkey can only do this with international support, especially the support of the United States.
Well, it seems to be a very intractable, a horrific humanitarian situation.
It is, totally. And as the winter comes, it will get worse. As the weather gets cold, and those people will be exposed to heavy weather situations, like extreme weather situations.
Well, we look forward to your visit to Tulsa. Mustafa Akgul, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much. I look forward to my visit, too. Thanks so much in meeting the people of Tulsa and having all these conversations.
Turkish journalist Mustafa Akgul speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He is the author of Islam Without Extremes, A Muslim Case for Liberty. He'll be the keynote speaker for the Institute of Interfaith Dialogue's annual Friendship Dinner and Award Ceremony Tuesday night in Tulsa, speaking on opportunities for democracy and liberties in the Middle East. For information on the event, visit interfaithdialogue.org/Oklahoma/Tulsa or call 918-812-7648. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.